number six, update on North Pacific Fishery Management Council actions. This is a briefing. Mr. Bill.
Good morning, Commissioners. Director and Deputy Director, I'm Bill Twite, Special Assistant to the Director. And this is a briefing on North Pacific Fishery Management Council activities over the last year. When I presented a briefing about a year ago regarding the North Pacific Council's activities in 2015, particularly relative to managing halibut bycatch, the commission at that time requested annual updates on halibut. And so this is that, but I also thought it was a good opportunity just to give you as well some information on a couple of the other things we did during 2016. So the major issues I'll be covering, first off, just a quick overview on how fisheries are doing, particularly in the Bering Sea, because that is the majority of the groundfish harvest. Secondly, on halibut bycatch management and what we did last year. Thirdly, then, on a couple of other fairly major accomplishments from 2016. Advances in how we're implementing electronic monitoring and development of what we call a recreational quota entity. First, a little bit of bragging. Groundfish stock status in the Bering Sea remains exemplary, I guess would be a modest word for it. This is a graph that we see every year when we review the status of all the groundfish stocks prior to setting our harvest regulations. And to orient you to this chart, this is produced by the scientists working for the Alaska Fisheries Science Center as well as our scientific peer review panel, our Science and Statistics Committee. To orient you to this, green is good. The terms of art that we use for troublesome areas are either that we are engaged in overfishing, which is obviously problematic, or a stock is overfished. Or the worst is when you're overfishing on an already overfished stock. And that's that little tiny corner in the upper left there. But basically those axes represent everything to the right of those axes is good in the green zone, and everything underneath the horizontal axis between overfishing and not overfished is also good. This is pretty extraordinary. It's extremely difficult in managing fisheries in a natural environment where stocks themselves go through some fairly dramatic fluctuations over time, and for reasons even other than fishing can often end up in a quote-unquote overfished status, which simply means that they're depleted below the point where you can fish at optimal rates. And the council's rates are actually buffered below optimal. Yes? So the dotted line is actually a buffer that we typically use for management above the actual overfished buffer, but that's where possible, we manage to stay above the dotted line just for an additional layer of conservatism. And this has fairly consistently been our record. This isn't unusual to have a graph like this for the Bering Sea, and it's actually equally good for the Gulf right now. Very few other councils can claim this kind of a record. The Pacific Council's record 15 years ago looked pretty bad. They've done a huge amount of work, and particularly as they've established more of an ecosystem-based approach, but also really embarked on some rigorous rebuilding. The Pacific Council's scorecard looks about like this nowadays. But beyond that, almost all the other national councils have much more mixed scorecards.
How many councils are there?
There are 8 regional councils in the U.S. So just for an idea of some scale here, the total actual allowable catch based on scientific assessments out of the Bering Sea in 2017 would be over 4 million metric tons. Our harvest is actually capped by congressional statute at 2 million metric tons, so we're going to leave about 2 million metric tons of groundfish in the water as part of the ecosystem this year. Now, groundfish aren't like salmon. If you don't catch them this year, many of them are still present the next year as well. So it provides a sort of a smoothing or a buffering function in terms of seafood yield. The pollock ABC alone, and pollock are the major contributor to this is 2.8 million metric tons. We'll end up taking about 1.35 million metric tons in 2017. The total value in 2015, which is the most recent year I have for economic value, of the groundfish harvest out of the Bering Sea and the Gulf is $894 million. That's 52% of the total Alaska seafood production value. Salmon and some of their coastal fisheries make up the other 48%. It's not all absolutely rosy, though. Things are starting to look a little more troubling. Every year we also get a State of the Ecosystem report as well as the State of the Fisheries report. And this year the State of the Ecosystem report sort of highlighted that now for three consecutive years, 2014 through 2016, we saw anomalously warm temperatures in the Bering Sea. As well, many of our other ecosystem indicators show signs of declining productivity. So even though the fish stocks themselves are continuing to assess as well in the green, we're very aware that there are troublesome signs in the ecosystem, and we're alert to declines. So halibut. It wasn't a very dramatic year for halibut, which is very good news from my perspective compared to 2015. But we did a fair amount of work, and we're continuing to do a fair amount of work. Beginning in 2015, we initiated development of a halibut management framework. It's rather astonishingly, the council had never really had a simple management framework for halibut. Because our management role is primarily managing the bycatch. We don't manage the directed fishery, other than providing allocation recommendations between commercial and recreational. The directed fishery is under the purview of the IPHC, and then the U.S. regulations are promulgated by National Marine Fisheries Service for the directed fishery. So our role, just in managing bycatch, is a very different role. But we'd never actually worked out an act framework for doing that. We began developing that in 2015, and we've still working on it, but it's finalized and guiding us now. And one of the things it's doing is ensuring a much closer, more cooperative working relationship with the IPHC, our management partner on halibut. Secondly, we indicated an interest in developing an abundance-based approach to managing the bycatch. Right now, our bycatch regulations are fixed. No matter how large or how small the halibut biomass, the caps on bycatch are the same. We've made significant progress on that, but there are very, very large difficulties remaining. So I don't know how well this is going to work out. We will end up adopting something that's abundance-based, but it may not be the kinds of models that we're used to doing that track abundance closely. It may end up having to be sort of a fairly simple set of steps. At low abundance, here's the bycatch cap. At mid abundance, here it is, et cetera. And the reason for that is that this is an unusual problem that at least is well outside of our experience in managing, and that is the bycatch fishery operates largely on a very different category of halibut than the directed fishery. Because the bycatch fishery is mostly impacting much younger age classes, there's several years between the biomass that you would manage the bycatch fishery off of and the biomass that you would manage the adult fishery off of. So they're not together in time, nor are they really together in space. Much of the bycatch occurs in the Bering Sea. Much of the directed fishery occurs in the Gulf and south, including off of our coast. And then thirdly, they're not the same in terms of length frequency either. The bycatch fish are by and large, are significantly smaller size classes as well. Many of those size classes never actually under current growth conditions, which is different than earlier, but at present, many halibut are simply never growing into the harvestable size class, particularly in the Bering Sea, because growth rates have really stalled out for halibut. This has happened before almost, I guess, three quarters of a century ago. We saw something similar. But the current definition that's used by the IPHC for what's a harvestable size halibut for the directed fisheries is larger than particularly many male halibut will ever grow in their lifetime at present. So these are very large difficulties. The scientific community is grappling with them. We have a really good working group of scientists from Alaska Fisheries Science Center, the IPHC scientists, as well as a couple of council staff working on this, coming up with suggested concepts. But it hasn't proved to be as simple as we'd hoped it would be, but we're continuing to work towards it. And we will end up with something. It's clearly unacceptable to have the directed fishery facing very large conservation restrictions and a bycatch fishery that's not facing sort of similar conservation. There's a basic equity issue there that we know has to be fixed. Last year, I mentioned a couple of different industry measures that we rely on the fishing cooperatives that do much of the industrial fishing that impacts halibut as bycatch. So 2016 was really the first full year of those cooperative agreements that were designed to really steer industry away from areas that have high halibut bycatch rates and into groundfish areas that don't, using in-season information. So essentially information flowing between all the different co-ops, between the different companies, that almost instantaneously. So hot spot areas get identified, get blocked off, the fleet moves away, finds areas of cleaner fishing, those areas then get worked. And as long as they stay clean and there's enough target fish there, then they work those areas. As they move on, as they move into a new area, the initial exploratory tows are kept short, and they really look for the presence of halibut to determine whether it's clean enough to do larger scale fishing. Those kinds of techniques appear to have worked very well in 2016. They came in well underneath the caps, the reduced caps that we set for them in 2015. And then finally, what we call deck sorting, which has been illegal, and that's the practice of before fish go down into the fish hold and into the factory, sorting through them on deck and putting the live halibut overboard. The reason that's been illegal is because if it's not done correctly, it's a great way for harvesters to simply avoid any accountability for the halibut whatsoever. From a scientific and a conservation standpoint, we need to know how many halibut are coming on board. And so we'd prohibited, in order to allow as complete and accurate a census as possible, we'd prohibited any discarding on deck. Instead, now what we've been doing, because there's obviously a large conservation wastage, particularly the larger halibut. If you can get them out of the stream of fish and back overboard pretty quickly, they have fairly high survival rates. And so what we've been doing under experimental fishing permit, and we'll be moving towards putting into regulation in another year, is finding out how to use one or two more observers to get an accurate enumeration of how many halibut go overboard. And as long as they're accurately enumerated, we come out ahead. It's a win-win at that point. But it does come at a higher cost. Industry has to pay for those extra observers. Initially, the agency had proposed four additional observers to do that. We've got it down to two. It's functioning pretty well at two right now, but even still, that's a pretty large expense. Ultimately, we'd like to see electronic monitoring. Push them through a chute. The chute takes a picture of them as they go overboard, gets a sense of how big it was and what condition it's in, and then a couple deck cameras to make sure that every halibut's actually going through the chute and not overboard. And we may be able to really pare this down. But right now it still relies on humans. Anyway, that continues to show progress as well. About half the fleet was engaged in the EFP in 2016, and that percentage is slated to rise significantly in 2017.
Is there any special handling that's required to return a live halibut? Like bottom fish needs special treatment, or can it just be pretty roughly handled and tossed in?
It can be fairly rough. Remember, these fish have been jostled around in a trawl for a little while as they're coming on board. The protocols that we're using are focused on the bigger fish. Work as fast as you can, particularly the first 20 minutes. That's your real time window. After that, survival begins to drop off pretty sharply. So what seems to be working so far is actually not worrying as much about being gentle as sorting quickly and getting through it quickly. Halibut are pretty hardy fish. We also don't see any signs of the barotrauma that you get, say, with rapid rise on a hook and line on single fish. There just don't appear to be those kinds of barotrauma issues at all. So the net result then in terms of numbers for 2016, in this small chart, you can see that the trawl fishery, their cap was 2,800 metric tons, and they came in well under it, 1,900. Of that, the Amendment 80 sector continues to be the single largest sector in the trawl fishery in terms of halibut bycatch. Their mortality at 1,327 tons, though, was also a significant drop from the previous couple of years. And then Pacific cod hook and line, equally, the hook and line, the longliner fleet has also been working on halibut bycatch reduction techniques, and as you can see, those in 2016 were also quite successful. They were 500 tons below their cap, well underneath. We were able to do this. The Amendment 80 sector capture was almost a one-third reduction from the previous year average. And right now, just to give you a sense of the kind of challenge this is, these numbers represent 1.2 kilograms of halibut per metric ton of groundfish. So there's not a lot of halibut per haul, but there's, given that there's a lot of hauls and a lot of harvest, the halibut numbers add up. But it's very much one of these, not exactly a needle in a haystack sort of issues, but it's a small numbers issue amidst a big stream of fish. And we were able to accomplish this. Yes?
So mortality is calculated by true dead fish.
Correct.
Of the observers and not ones that were thrown back over.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the actual occurrence rate's a little higher, more like a couple or 3 kilograms per metric ton. But it's still, as you can see, the I was thinking trying to do a visual, and I couldn't make one work. But it's a small dot on a large cube. And we were able to, in 2016, at some expense to some of the companies, these are in aggregate probably a couple million dollars worth of management choices and management expenses in order to avoid halibut, increased running time, increased fuel consumption, choosing to fish in areas where the pollock are somewhat lower quality, those kinds of decisions that end up costing money but are very difficult to quantify. But we were still, the bottom line is, were we able to achieve the full scheduled harvest? 1.935 million metric tons is a little under the 2 million cap. We never hit the cap. For a lot of reasons, there's so many management buffers built into the system. So 1.935 is pretty darn close, and that's about how close we usually come. With that, I'll move on to a couple of other issues we worked on.
Just a quick question before you move on. Thank you. I appreciate you coming back, mm-hmm. by the way. I hope other commissioners find this informative. I know I do. And I do recall... you know, there was a lot of tension between the halibut harvesting fleet and, you know, the Amendment 80 folks. And has the efforts of the council, has that helped ease that tension? Maybe I'll just ask that and then follow up.
Thanks. My barometer for that is Mayor Simeon Swetsoff of St. Paul on the Pribilof Islands, and he's a directed halibut fisher. And he says in his testimony at this last meeting, he said, well, what happened in 2016 makes me a little more comfortable, but I'm not quite done sweating yet. So, and I thought that was actually pretty accurate. That reflected the tenor of what I was hearing in the hallways as well. There is a strong appreciation from the directed harvesters about the efforts that the bycatch fishery took. At the same time, they are cats and dogs. I mean, this is an age-old allocation issue that doesn't go away overnight.
Right, right.
And there is equally a concern that as halibut, we think we're seeing, and the IPHC is projecting some rising trend in halibut biomass, which is good news overall. But initially, it's tough because that rising trend accrues to the bycatch fishery several years before it begins to accrue to the directed fishery. The bycatch fishery has to work even harder to try to avoid a rising abundance that isn't yet And everybody's nervous about that. That will continue to inflame tensions.
And just to then, I appreciate the response. That's helpful. And I think you mentioned it too. The challenge now for the directed halibut fishers is the failure of these fish to grow into harvestable size, and that's still, as you mentioned, scientists are looking into that, trying to just figure out what's going on. So the decrease in the halibut mortality in the groundfish isn't necessarily resulting, at least right now, in bigger catches for the directed harvesters.
It did to some extent, because some portion of the halibut bycatch is actually fish of harvestable size. That reduction alone was enough to provide some additional room, particularly for the Bering Sea directed harvest.
Okay, good. Thanks.
So, and then just finally, on that point about growth, the North Pacific Council did suggest in letter to the IPHC that, you know, you could choose a somewhat different harvestable size here. And the IPHC hasn't responded yet, but has indicated that they will begin a dialogue with us on that. But that would actually address some of these issues as
well. What is the size?
Oh, gosh. 032? Bob, you probably...
No, I don't. Yeah. We have to rely on Bob Alverson for that. Answer to that.
There's three different size cutoffs. Much of the bycatch operates on what we call 026, fish larger than 26 inches. Our next management cutoff is 32, and then our final one's 36. And I should be able to remember that, but it's at least 6, if not 10 inches larger than the size where they begin to show up in and as I say, the current indications are that many males are simply never growing into that. And it's either 32 or 36.
I'd like to try to understand the biology. Is reproduction related to age, size? Is that one of the issues in setting a size limit to the directed fishery?
No, it was primarily initially set primarily around market considerations. There isn't a lot of information for halibut. You're probably thinking of some of the rockfish populations where there's a very clear correlation. The larger, older females have a much higher fecundity and apparently as well have a much higher contribution rate kind of over and above fecundity to the populations. That hasn't been demonstrated for halibut. As a flatfish, they tend not to show as much. But there are scientists who point out it's kind of logical to think that the larger a female gets, the more valuable she is that way. But there's no conclusive. Okay, moving on. One of the things that we adopted in 2016 is a project we'd been working on for almost 5 years. And this is part of how we've restructured our whole observer program for the groundfish fisheries in the North Pacific, including the halibut-directed fisheries as well as the other groundfish fisheries. Our observer program right now, if you're a large vessel, like a catcher processor or the larger trawl catcher vessels, if you have a high impact on Chinook salmon bycatch, for instance, you have either 100 or 200% human observer on board. And we haven't restructured that. What we've been restructuring is the large fleet of smaller vessels that we don't have full-time observer on board requirements. Instead, we use random sampling with the observer program to accomplish that. And we've been initially, as we restructured, we focused on the vessels that we knew could pretty easily accommodate a human observer for a several-day trip. That left a significant portion of the fleet that there were some difficulties accommodating a human observer. And unfortunately, that in leaving them out of the sampling program, that creates some level of bias in your estimates that we wish to address. And so we've been working hard with industry to develop electronic monitoring tools that essentially substitute for having a human on board. And this last year, in 2016, we finalized that work, and we now adopted a final package for how we're going to do that, and we're moving that into regulations. So we expect that by 2018, we will be using a mixed suite of cameras and humans on many of those vessels to both estimate catch as well as estimate bycatch, so both retained and bycatch. This is a somewhat different approach than the Pacific Council has taken with its electronic monitoring development. The Pacific Council has chosen to go largely with full retention, and so the function of an observer is simply to ensure that fish aren't being discarded overboard and everything gets sampled at the buyers, or with logbook programs where the skipper themselves. And those work well for the Pacific Council, and that's the choice of the stakeholders down there. The stakeholders in both the Bering Sea and the Gulf wanted a somewhat different approach where we actually use the observers and or the cameras to estimate catch and bycatch at sea when it happens, and base our management off those data, which our management system already accommodated that, so it wasn't a big leap. But it meant a somewhat different adaptation process than the Pacific Council's gone through. Anyway, we've now worked with vessels. We still haven't really cracked open the under 40s yet in terms of this, but for vessels over 40 foot now, we've got an electronic monitoring package that is ready to go. We're hoping to have this be a competitive marketplace. So we're hoping to be able to harness, and part of that will be in the rules that get developed. Part of it will be in the actual contracts that get signed by NIMFs on our behalf. But hoping to essentially now turn it back over to industry and competition to continue to develop the kinds of cameras, the kinds of data storage devices, the kinds of sensors, et cetera, as well as the flow of data that will be cheapest and most cost-effective. But we have developed prototypes for all that that are reasonably cheap and reasonably cost-effective, but we think costs can drop even further. Data storage and analysis are still some of the largest under federal regulation. A lot of these data have to be stored for 5 years, and because they're visual images, they're expensive to store. So again, it's an area we think we'll continue to work on. We're going to try and keep that the development as far outside of regulation as possible, again, to allow the marketplace to develop cost-effective solutions. But what we've developed does have broad applicability to a wide range of small fishing vessel fleets. I can see this kind of thing working extremely well in cases where right now we need human observers, like on purse seiners, for instance. I think this kind of technology could work very, very well. The final point I wanted to make on this is that we would not have gotten there without some really strong third-party funding. Industry has done a lot of the development. It's been bottom-up, but they obviously don't have the funds to actually do much of the initial prototype testing, et cetera. So organizations like the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, which has a strong mission around implementing electronic monitoring, have been essential and continued. They are continuing to make grants to others. They've graduated us essentially out of their, or are graduating us out of their program now. But they're continuing to look. So it's a promising area in terms of fishery monitoring that I think definitely recommend keeping your eye on. The other thing that we did this year that was quite innovative is establish what we call a recreational quota entity, and this is to address the long-standing battle between the recreational and commercial directed users for halibut. The council for a long time, we'd simply avoided it entirely, which was not working well. We adopted a catch-sharing plan, our first sort of formal catch-sharing plan for the two sectors about 6 or 7 years ago. The effects of that catch-sharing plan on the recreational, the charter halibut fishery at low levels of abundance has been extremely difficult for them to cope with. And we've been dealing with relatively low levels of abundance now for several years in what we call the directed harvestable portion of the biomass. And one of the things that's been set up is because we don't, as a council, regulate the non-guided recreational. We only regulate the guided for reasons that go way back. We actually now are in the very unfortunate position of having different regulations for sport harvesters, depending upon whether they go on a charter or a non-charter. You can imagine the complications there. Extremely difficult. So the council has, for a couple of years, worked closely, particularly with the charter halibut industry in both southeast and south central Alaska, which are the two areas where the problem exists, to establish a form of what we call compensated reallocation. In other words, adjust the existing allocations, but do it in a way that the commercial fishers are actually compensated for that adjustment. And because the commercial fishery is a catch-share fishery, where the individual harvesters don't own, but they have their granted rights for a period of time, but those rights are actually fungible. Any reallocation that doesn't involve compensation essentially becomes then a diminishment of every commercial harvest, the value of every commercial harvester's quota. And when you've taken out bank loans in order to be able to afford the quota, when you've mortgaged your house and other things in order to be able to do that, that's extremely threatening, extremely destabilizing, as well as you well know, these kinds of allocation battles are divisive between stakeholders. They take your attention away from other more important things. So the compensated reallocation idea involves the charter industry in both South Central and Southeast forming entities, and within Alaska, this has been done already. They have the regional aquaculture entities, for instance, that are chartered organizations under both state and federal law, and I can't cite it, but they are authorized to raise funds and accomplish things on behalf of their fishery. In some cases, running aquaculture programs, in other cases, running marketing programs, things like that. So in this case, the regional quota entities are first off authorized to form under state law as charter organizations that are then allowed to purchase IFQ, commercial IFQ, from willing sellers as it goes up on the market. They're authorized to purchase it and hold it on behalf of a larger allocation to their area for the recreational fishery in their area. So IFQ flows from individual commercial harvesters to the recreational sector, and then they hold it and use it to essentially buy up their that then bolsters their allocation. And the goal is to be able to restore parity between the guided and the non-guided sectors. So the regulations would always be the same between both. Another goal is to just have a seasonal stability to the charter allocation so that they're able to, they begin their marketing, say, for the year 2018. They begin that in the late summer of 2017. Well, the regulations aren't established for the halibut fishery until the actual IPHC meeting in January of 2018, well after they've done much of their marketing for the next year. This kind of approach and allowing that sort of stability to the regulations, they can confidently market their fishing opportunity on halibut a year out with that kind of thing. At least those are the two goals. We believe this is well enough designed to do that. The issue right now is still exactly how to obtain funding, but they're beginning to work right now to organize to develop these regional associations, and they'll probably start with a self-levy. It looks like they may go to the Alaska legislature and see if it's possible to also have a halibut stamp. That's under consideration as well, as another way of raising the funds for that. So I don't know how this is going to turn out, but I thought this was worth calling to your attention. As far as we know, nobody's ever tried this before anywhere, and it seems like a promising sort of approach. It's dependent on a very, very particular set of circumstances, though. This is a process that took 5-plus years of intensive work by both the council and stakeholders, too. So it's not any kind of magic panacea, and it may not fit many other situations other than this, but the concept's interesting. And I believe that's it. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Picture of that halibut, my Sitka halibut, I used one like that for bait.
Well, I didn't want to point out, but for those of you who do know Washington geography well, that's not Alaska. That's Nea Bay.
But I still use one that size for bait. thank you. That was always great. Any other questions? No? Thanks, Bill.